Seth, I'm sorry. I should have warned you that I was going to bang that gavel. Welcome to the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. If you have a cell phone, please turn it on vibrate. If it goes off during the committee, I'll ask you to make a $5 contribution to your favorite charity, which in this case might be the Common School Fund. We are going to open as a subcommittee because we have two members absent and one member testifying on a bill. This is the time of year where every member is everywhere because bills are flying and we need to be places. So we will start out as a subcommittee. We're going to start out with an overview of the community college and workforce issues. And I'm going to call up Cam Price-Brawley, who I've gotten to know very well now, and Andrea Henderson, who I also know very well. So come on up. And sometimes we get a little double duty. And we got a third person.
Yeah.
Cool. I like surprises. All right. So somebody start and announce yourself and who you're with.
Okay. I will start. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. The Oregon Community College Association represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. You should have a handout from us. And what we wanted to start with was to talk about who we are, both who I represent and who Cam represents, so that as we are talking about it, you understand the various roles that we have within the community colleges. The Oregon Community College Association is an association of the 17 colleges. It is an organization that is governed by a 34-member board of each president of the college and one a locally elected board member of the colleges. And the association serves to represent the community college interests before the legislature and also serves as an association to provide board member training, communication, and other services to the colleges. And with that, I'll let Cam talk for just a moment about who she is and who she represents.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I am Cam Price-Brawley. I'm the commissioner for community colleges. I am also the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I would hope that you were on page 2 of the slide packet that we brought you. We did, as Andrea said, wanted to delineate how we were the same and how we were different. I do work for the State Board of Education, which has oversight authority over the 17 community colleges as well as the Department of Education and the 198 school districts. You probably well know your local community college board members and your presidential leaders, but we thought it was important for you to also put a face and a name. With us this afternoon is Susan Wolf. She is Dean of Instruction at Columbia Gorge Community College, and she's that most far hand column representative today, and she will call on her later in our presentation to give you a feel for the local community college. I'm going to run pretty quickly through why we believe education is important. Andrea's then going to cover some facts and figures about community colleges, and then I'll come back to workforce development issues, all we hope in a very tidy amount of time.
Yeah, very 30-minute presentation. This is not your Ways and Means Committee. This is your mother's Oldsmobile. So we will do the short version.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
We would like to start with just reminding the committee about why we believe education is so important. Most of the jobs in the future will require increasing amount of skills if Oregon and the United States is going to remain competitive. We believe that community colleges and workforce development are key partners in the development of that 21st century workforce. Just to drive home that point on slide number 4, we take a picture in time. In 1950, 20% of the jobs in the economy were skilled, and in 2002, when we looked at the same set of jobs, those that were high skill and high wage made up 65% of the total jobs. Community colleges and our other post-secondary education partners are the ones that provide those critical skills, and those are the skills that matter more than ever. Moving on to page 5, this is a picture of where those skilled jobs will be and what level of education will be required for them. The fastest growing across all business sectors will require post-secondary education. And the single largest job growth area, that at 32%, is the associate's degree. I'm on to page 6. What you have there is a graphic illustration of how Oregon is doing in attracting and keeping students in our educational system. You may have seen this in the Measuring Up and other documents that are published by the post-secondary education system. But it shows you that for every 100 ninth grade students that are in high school, 69% of them actually graduate 4 years later. That's the benchmark. And of that 100, 15% graduate with either an associate's or a bachelor's 3 or 6 years later.
Thank you. I think that elicited a question from Senator Starr.
Yes. How well are we following that cohort, that original 100, to that period 8 years later or whatever that is? Is it the same cohort? Are we finally getting that kind of record keeping that we can follow the cohort all the way through?
Chair Walker, Senator Starr, I would say that they are not the exact same people. They are cohort aged, and in that cohort year they are tracked for 8 to 10 years to see how they do. We are, as you are probably well aware, in the beginning stages of a data collection system that will be able to track both aggregate and individual progress, but we are not at a stage where we can tell you that, you know, John started in ninth grade and John finished his bachelor's at the University of Oregon 8 years later. It is done by a cohort.
Thank you.
We believe that if we want the robust economy for Oregon that has those high-wage, high-skill jobs, that we need to reduce our attrition and increase our completion rates. We don't simply want to import our most talented people. We need to grow our own. And in order to do that, on slide number 7, we believe Oregon must raise the bar. And there are some ideas here that are part of the Oregon business plan about how we might actually do that. But it will take educated citizens to meet the bar for increased economic growth and increased productivity and profitability. We believe that Oregon's community colleges do provide Oregonians, no matter their background or circumstance, to set and reach their own personal bar. This slide number 8 is also a picture of how males and females, by the level of education that they receive, what a difference it makes in their learning, or their learning and earning ability over time. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Andrea.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Starr. Community colleges play a key role on providing the opportunities and the dreams for Oregonians. We have collected the mission statements and vision from the 17 community colleges and put in slide number 9 the similarities between those vision and mission statements in terms of what community colleges see as their critical role for you to take a look at. Turning to slide number 10, I wanted to talk for a few minutes in terms of how community colleges are responsive to their community needs. And this chart here shows you the type of services that community colleges offer and the amount of FTE in terms of how much of the community college mission is spent in those specific areas. Community colleges serve their community in a variety of different ways. If you are someone who doesn't have basic skills in order to get a job, the community college can help you, whether you need to have your GED You have basic reading and writing areas that you need to work on. If you need ESL classes, the community colleges are available to help you in those areas. And that's about 18% of the FTE statewide in community colleges is for those services. If you are someone that needs to find a job and need a very specific certificate or associate's degree to have that job, whether it be in some of the allied health fields, auto tech, a variety of different areas, the community colleges offer that. And that's about 32% of the FTE that's offered on a statewide basis is for those services. The community colleges also play a key role in being the access point for post-secondary education for Oregonians. Currently, about 44% of the FTE in community colleges is in lower division transfer, and these are for students who, for many of them, go on to get a four-year degree or need lower division transfer classes for their professional technical degrees. Our community colleges also provide adult continuing education. Most of this is in workforce areas and in health areas. That's about 4% of what we do. And this would also include those areas when community colleges contract with specific businesses for their workforce needs and provide information and training for those.
Senator Stark?
I'm following you, I think, but would you clarify for me what the FTE is related to? Is that professional or professors hours involved in the program, or is that student enrollment?
Chair Walker, Senator Starr, FTE is a full-time equivalent. So it's essentially the one FTE equals 510 contact hours with that particular student. It is not a headcount, but it's actually a contact hour. So the actual headcount of students would be far different.
That answers my question. I want to be sure I understood it correctly. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sometimes it means different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, good question. Thank you.
If you turn to the handout on page 11, this tells you a little bit about where community colleges are around the state. We are everywhere in the state. The community colleges on this map show both our main campuses by a triangle and a little dot that shows all of our outreach centers. Part of the community college mission is to be accessible to Oregonians. So essentially that means to be where Oregonians live and work, not to force them to come to us, but for us to come to them so that we can provide to their educational needs. Moving to slide 12, community colleges also serve students of all ages. And we serve students that are under the age of 15 all the way to students that are over the age of 65. It's a very diverse group of students. But I would point out that the largest segment of students that we serve is those in the 25 to 44-year age. For our students on slide 13, the bulk of community college students are part-time students. As you can see here, the small percentage of our students are enrolled full-time. A small percentage is enrolled in part-time basis, which would be 6 to 11 hours. The bulk of our students are those that are taking part-time. These are students who have full-time jobs, they have families, and they come to the community college to pick up the classes they need, but they are not full-time students. Also, for the part-time students, they are not eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant at this point. From that, I wanted to turn a little bit to what's happening with our funding and access to community colleges. On slide 14, it demonstrates what's happened over the last several years with the community college funding. Very simply, the amount of funding from the state has dropped, and the amount that students are paying in tuition is increasing. Students over the last couple of years have moved from paying for 20% of their cost of education to 30% of the cost of education and are bearing a higher burden for the cost of attending school. As the funding has dropped, I also have several charts that show you specifically with the tuition what has happened. In slide 15, it shows you the increase in tuition fairly dramatically since the fall of 2001, what has happened with the yearly tuition rate for our community college students. If you look at the next slide, slide number 16, it compares our tuition on a yearly basis to tuition in our neighboring states. Not only are we the highest among our four neighboring states, but Oregon has the highest tuition out of all 15 western states. On average, a student in Oregon pays $800 more a year than the average tuition in the 15 western states. So this is a significant burden on our students, and it does make it difficult for them to both attend community college and to complete community college. As the funding has dropped, not only has the tuition gone up, but the actual course offerings in the community colleges have dropped as well. The chart on page 17 shows you the drop in number of course sections that community colleges are offering around the state. As the course sections have dropped, it limits the access that students cannot get into the classes they need at the times that they need. One of the values of community colleges, as I stated earlier, was to be available for the students where the students need us. It's also very important for community colleges to be available when the students need it. For students that are working full-time, often their availability to attend classes is limited, and we try very hard to make sure that the classes are available at times and locations that are convenient for them to attend. That opportunity is far less than it has been in the last several years. All of this has had an impact on the enrollments in community colleges. And the slide on page 18 shows you the drop in enrollments both in the FTE and the headcount. Shows you the actual drop. In a headcount, we have dropped from serving over 400,000 Oregonians to serving 330,000 Oregonians last year. So that's a loss of 70,000 Oregonians who were in community colleges but no longer are. These 70,000 Oregonians who are not in community colleges, for the most part, aren't in education anywhere. They've dropped out because they can't afford to attend or they can't get the class sections that they need. And so these are students who do not have the opportunity to actually move forward with getting a family wage job for their families or to get the degree that they are seeking. I wanted to end by talking a little bit about the OCCA legislative priorities and recognizing this is not the Ways and Means Committee. Did want to let you know what our major priorities are for this legislative session. I know it won't surprise you to find that they're all around funding. We are asking for a support fund funding to the Community College Support Fund of $440 million. This is $23 million less than what we received in 2001. We also are seeking support for capital construction at 6 community colleges and support additional funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, particularly for our part-time students who are being priced out of an education.
And Ms. Henderson, for the benefit of Senator Starr, who doesn't serve on Ways and Means, can you please tell us about the capital construction, just briefly how you came down to those 6 community colleges? Because I thought you went through a very good process of determining who should get that money.
Certainly, Senator Walker. Community colleges have not received capital construction from the state since 1979. We did bring a capital construction package last session, which was not approved. In the interim, we went through a process with the 17 community colleges to first ask the community colleges for their priorities. Once those requests were received, the community colleges then ranked those projects to come up with a prioritized list for the community colleges. Of that, the highest priority was for those colleges who did not have a current adequate campus or had tremendous structural needs at their community college. The top 6 projects that were on the prioritized list are funded in the governor's budget, and we are seeking support for those 6 projects in this legislative session.
And it's also my understanding those projects had to show that they could pass a bond levy.
Yes, they did. Okay. Chair Walker, Senator Starr, those of the 6 that are in the governor's budget, 3 of them have already passed their match. The program for capital construction requires that the community college pass or otherwise provide funding on a 50-50 match basis with the state. So without that match from the local community, the state funds would not be available. 3 of our colleges, Rogue Community College, Columbia Gorge Community College, and Oregon Coast Community College, all were able to pass bonds in the last election to support these projects. The other 3 community colleges will be seeking elections after the legislative session.
What is amazing, Senator Starr, is that some of those districts have high unemployment, and they still passed a bond measure for their community colleges. That's really says a lot about what that means to their community.
So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Cam Preuss-Brawley to talk about the State Board of Education and the Workforce Board. Thank you.
picking up where Andrea left off, we did want to talk a little bit about the workforce development issues and thought the best way to frame that was on slide 21, where it talks about the governance structure, if you will, and the goals from three different boards. As I said earlier, I am employed by the State Board of Education, and you have the list of goals there for that board. The State Board of Education works in conjunction with the State Board of Higher Education in an entity that's called the Joint Boards of Education, and we have listed their goals. I also am responsible in the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development for over $100 million worth of federal job training and federal education dollars, and much of that is governed by the Oregon Investment Workforce Investment Board. So I am not schizophrenic. I really am able to keep all three of these boards and their goals sort of aligned and moving in the same direction. It was important, I think, to articulate what the Workforce Board, that's the shorthand, rather than saying the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, has as its goals, because they mirror much of the work that's done by community colleges and seemed like a very nice segue to maintain a skilled workforce, to look at improving efficiencies and effectiveness of workforce delivery, meeting the needs of Oregon's youth, and ensuring that there is access to lifelong learning. We are moving on to page 22. The workforce development system in Oregon has adopted a brand that is called WorkSource Oregon. It is a statewide network of public and private partners that work together to deliver business services and services to individuals who are either seeking their first, next, or better job. We do this on page 23 is a map that looks similar to the map for the community colleges. We have 15 regions of the state. They are developed through a certification process that is actually federally required with guidance from our office and the governor's office to be organized around local labor markets. So these 15 regions exist with a local board that helps them decide where they use their resources. And you can see there, by all these dots, there are over 40 places in the state that are one-stop centers. We liken it to Fred Meyer one-stop shopping. An individual can go and receive a variety of services, either a business looking for trained workers or workers looking for a job.
Do you charge a fee to businesses who use those services?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Do you charge a fee to businesses for using those services?
Madam Chair, no. They are. That's what the federal resources come to the state to do.
Okay.
So it's free to both the employee, the worker, and to the business. There are some fee-for-service services, mm-hmm. but by I would say only a very small portion of them are actually carry any charge at all.
So you're a new and improved type of employment office. In the old days, mm-hmm. go sign up for work at the employment office, check to see what was available. Now you can go to the Workforce or WorkSource Oregon Center around the state and find what you need there.
Madam Chair, you're exactly right. It is under the WorkSource brand that a variety of state agencies have banded together so that employers and job seekers and workers see a common brand and logo and know that they can receive that service, so that you would see that little Oregonoid that you see in the, that's what we call him, the WorkSource Oregon Oregonoid, on the side of a building. And it could be an employment department, it could be a community college, it could be a community-based organization that is all partners in delivering this set of services.
So as I understand how this would work, if a large employer were thinking about siding into Marion County, for instance, they would contact the WorkSource folks here in Marion County, which I assume there is one here. If I put my glasses on, I can see that. And then they would say, okay, we want to site a business here. We need 300 employees. Do you think that you can facilitate that for us? And that would be all part of the discussion about bringing them in.
Madam Chair, you have exactly right.
Okay, great. And that's what I thought. And we are going to visit the Lane Workforce Center in April, on one of our field hearings, April 15th. Senator Starr? So could you see one of the bigger ones in the state?
Oh, Chair, would that be the Oakmont?
No, the one out at LCC.
At LCC, okay.
Right. Yeah, busy day. File your taxes. File that extension form. I'll get you one if you need it. All right, I'll let you move on because we're
all right. I'm on slide 24.
Okay.
As I have indicated, WorkSource Oregon. Oregon did not choose to merge many different departments together. Many states did. Sort of the flagship of that would be the state of Texas, which merged three or four departments together. They now have 5,000 employees under a workforce commission. Rubric. Oregon said, well, we would rather get better and more efficient at delivering our service than not reorganize. So instead, we have the Workforce Investment Board, and you will be hearing a bill a little later this afternoon on some changes that we would like to make to that board to make it more efficient. It is guided by a majority of business members. We also, I indicated that there were regional boards around the state, and there are 15 of those, the 40 workforce centers, and then the Workforce Policy Cabinet is the state-level group of which I am a member, as is the Employment Department and others that help guide the work of the WorkSource Oregon. Slide 25 gives you just a sampling of the services that a business might find at WorkSource Oregon, from recruitment, as we discussed earlier, Chair Walker, labor market information, financial assistance with worker training, and other items that they might need. Slide 26 is then a list of common elements that you would find at a one-stop center for if you were a worker or a job seeker, the kind of information and assistance that you would receive. You will see that there is a link at the bottom of slide 26, the WorkSourceOregon.org. We have combined the different agencies all under this one website. And if you are a business, you click on For Business. And if you are a worker, you click on For Workers. And it will actually take you to the geographic place that you are wanting to either move to or you live in. So it's geared to be particularly helpful for individuals in their community. Slide 27 and 28 are lists of factoids, if you will, of the performance that the WorkSource Oregon programs have delivered in the last year. This is for 2003-04. I'm not going to, in the interest of time, run through them.
That's a good placement rate, though.
It is. 71%. We are pleased, given our economic realities, that we have done as well as we have. We are pleased with an 82-cent per hour wage gain from entry to exit of individuals, even though it may not sound like a lot. You know, we believe it is. And page 28 continues with more of the data points of employers that have been served and workers that have been trained. And this one is particular to this slide 28 talks mostly about, you know, workers that are already working and are getting skill enhancement or upgrade training while they are on the job site. So what does all of this mean to a local community college? As we have asked Susan Wolf to join us today to give you a sense of how workforce development and community colleges
connect with their community college.
Thank you for the opportunity to come back before the legislature. I was here in front of the Ways and Means a few weeks ago talking about capital construction and what that means for our communities as well. So, Chair Walker and Senator Starr, I hope to paint a picture of one of those small rural colleges, but...
After you state your name, you can...
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Susan Wolf, for the record, excuse me. I am Susan Wolf. I am the Dean of Instruction at Columbia Gorge Community College in the Dalles. And thank you for that reminder.
Well, we have listeners out there.
I understand that. They don't know who I am.
That's right. And sometimes people can't sleep at night, and they're channel surfing, and they come across the legislature, and they're so fascinated.
That's right. Thank you very much. Even though I'm going to focus my remarks on one college where I am currently located, please understand that I am representing all of the colleges, and probably particular all of those located in the rural areas, the hard-to-serve populations. And we happen to be riding the crest of a wave right now that's very exciting, not only for our communities, but also for the state. You'll see from the slide that's on page 29, and it says, Pinchas, we're dreaming. And even though it's not St. Patrick's Day where we can pinch one another, last week I happened to be down here for another meeting, and I went home and I got all of the Dalles Chronicle newspapers, and every day when I opened that up, there was a new story of a new employer coming to our region. The largest one that was announced about 3 weeks ago is Google Corporation is coming to the Dalles, Oregon, and I spoke to the Ways and Means Committee about why we were chosen for that. But that didn't happen by a fluke or by accident. You'll see from this slide that it's taken many, many years of hard work by our community partners, including city, county, the local hospitals, the chambers, the small business people, who have very clearly had a dream and they've had a vision for our area. And even though at times we have had the highest unemployment rate in the country, they didn't let that stop the dream. And I think that the mission statement for our college, Building Dreams and Transforming Lives, really fits our communities as well. So 20 years ago, there was a local election, and we formed the Port of the Dalles, and all those entities came together, and again, they were looking at a vision, not for that day, but for down the road. And here we are 20 years later, and we're still looking 20 years beyond. How can we be better prepared for what our region will become? One of the reasons the Dalles did, or the Google did come to the Dalles, is the Q-Life fiber optic loop that we have that was installed. And again, it was through the community and the public agencies, private agencies working together on that. I think that that entity, that decision, will have paybacks for a long, long time, because not only did Google look at that, but since Google came, we've had two other manufacturers announce that they're coming to the region. We have other people that are showing interest. We are getting to the point now where do we have available land for people choosing to buy homes? So we're talking about economic vitality. When I spoke in front of the Ways and Means, I didn't talk about economic recovery, because we're looking for vitality. And I want to focus just a little bit for a minute about that can-do attitude. Cam was talking also about the quality of life in some of her previous statements. And community colleges not only educate people and train a highly skilled workforce, we also prepare people to be quality citizens and community members. And our communities are serving as excellent role models of what happens when you collaborate and work together, and we work with our state partners. I mean, that didn't happen alone. The State Economic Development Board, CAM's office, OCCA, they were all involved when we were beginning to make some of these things happen. The last piece on here that I would like to talk about, or maybe the last two, is when we passed our $18.5 million bond last fall. Again, that came at the end of a time of very high unemployment. Now, our unemployment rate is still 8%. And for those people, both rural and urban, to say we're willing to give you this much money because we believe in you and what you can do for us, that was just a tremendous success. That also showed the businesses wanting to locate, why they wanted to come. I think you also received a copy of an editorial that was in the local paper, and it's talked about highly the value that the college brings for that. So with all that in mind, again, we're looking to the future. We're not looking just for today, and it's not just the future of the Dalles, Wasco County, Hood River counties, and some of the others that we serve in those rural areas, but we're talking about vitality for the state of Oregon. So we're pleased as one of the 17 community colleges to play a role for helping Oregon recover and move forward. So thank you.
Thank you. That the last comment in the editorial, taking the longer view and investing in the development of local facilities always pays off,
yeah.
is very true. And
it is.
I think that's true about our community college system
mm-hmm.
as well. We're back to a full committee now. Welcome, Senator Cruz. Hope your bill went well.
It did, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Good. Any questions from the committee?
Full speed ahead.
Thank you.
That's what I say. Well, great. Well, thank you for your presentation. And we've lumped a few things in here today that have relevance to community colleges. And I think you've signed up to testify in a couple of those camps. So I appreciate you coming back, all of you, and especially you, Dr. Wolf. It's a trip coming down, and your time is appreciated. Okay, well, we're going to, Kim, you can just stay where you are. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 85. These are two quick little bills we're just going to dispense with, and then we'll get to another one where we've got some kids here. So I'll have Marjorie tell us about Senate Bill 85. I actually remembered to do that today.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 85 allows recipients of advanced technology education and training grants or loans to use those funds for any specified purposes.
Okay.
And this is an agency bill.
It's an agency bill. So, Ms. Price-Brawley, tell us who you are again and why you think this is a good idea.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cam Price-Brawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges. Senate Bill 85 is almost exactly the same as Senate Bill 272 from the 2003 session, with the exception of a fix to the language that is, let me find it, so right to it. Now that is in chapter law, it's a little more difficult to find. We have a list in section, I didn't bring my highlighted section, I'm sorry, this would be section 1. 5A, we were on line 28 of the actual bill. We worked this bill with the professional technical education community, with the Association of Oregon Industries, with legislative leadership last session. We unfortunately had in section 5A a list of very important criteria for individual programs and partnerships to come forward to receive the resources that were in this bill, except at the end it said and in that list of 11 instead of or. So you had to meet all the criteria instead of some of the criteria. So Ooh. The technical fix here is that we were unable to invest in new partnerships as we had intended with the $49,000 of lottery that was in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would, even though there is not resources attached to this bill, we still think it's a good idea and would like to get that technical fix made as the bill is presented to you.
Well, it's amazing what a three-letter word will do. all right. Any questions by the committee? And you're the only one signed up to testify, so I am not for Senate Bill 85, Senator Westland.
Oh, I have some very salient remarks. Apparently, I'll just
speak to myself. Madam Chair, Senator Westland has tried to testify on every bill and every committee so far today.
Ah, he has. Well, we don't have enough for him to do. I think we'll have to change that. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 85 and thank Ms. Price-Brawley for her testimony. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 85, and I bet Senator Starr has
Madam Chair,
motion.
I move Senate Bill 85. to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 85 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Cool. This bill's going. We're done with that bill. And I'm going to... Would you like to do a little bill that changes an and to an or?
I could do that in probably 15 seconds.
I think so, too. All right. Well, Senator Cruz will carry that bill. And then do we want to skip ahead? Okay. Senator Westland, if you'll just stay with us, we're going to just be about 2 minutes. Okay. Great. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 187. Ms. Price-Brawley, again, if you'll come forward, and Gwen Harvey.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 187 modifies the membership requirements for the State Workforce Investment Board. And again, it's an agency bill.
It's an agency bill with probably a similar problem. I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Cam Price-Brawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges. Yes, you have Senate Bill 187. It does modify the membership of the requirements for the State Workforce Investment Board, which we talked about just a little earlier. It has been, it was drafted in 1997 to comply with federal legislation that existed at that time. The Workforce Investment Act is up for reauthorization this year. With me is Gwen Harvey. She is the current chair of the Workforce Board. She's just returned last evening from Washington, D.C., where she could, I'm sure, tell us way more than we would like to know about how reauthorization is going on the bill. But I would like for her to be able to say a few words about the need for the changes in the bill.
Thank you, and welcome back to Oregon. I hope we have better weather.
Much better. There was a snowstorm in D.C. when I left Cincinnati. It was snowing even harder.
Oh, well, we've only had sunshine and Mount St. Helens Ash.
I think
we're doing pretty good.
We could have used the snow, not
All right. State your name for us, please.
My name is Gwen Harvey. As Cam made reference to, I chair the Oregon Workforce Investment Board as a business representative to the board. I'm also the national chair of the State Chairs Association, so I chair all of the state boards around the country as well, too. So my perspective sometimes is a little broader on issues. I wanted to talk with you today and want to thank you for the opportunity to present before you today some encouragement and hopefully some enticement to support this bill and allow it to move forward. As Cam has referenced earlier, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board is federally required under the Workforce Investment Act, which was enacted in 1998. That act is due to expire, and we're looking at reauthorization right now at the federal level. The OWIB, and I'll use the acronym, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, is a business-led board with 51% of the members coming from the business community from across the state of Oregon. And we are charged with recommending workforce development policies that drive our public workforce system here in Oregon. The board is really must be flexible. Sometimes we have to act very quickly. We use a subcommittee structure to help us advance some of our work so that we can be more flexible. Sometimes we have very little time to respond to policy issues. Sometimes we have a great amount of time to do so. State law now mandates that we have 41 members on that workforce board. That is, as you can imagine, a fairly large and interesting board to manage from a chair's perspective.
41? Did you say 41?
41 members.
Holy
and again, 51% of those members come from business. We have labor representatives on the board. Cam is on our board. The chancellor of the higher ed system is on our board. Debbie Lincoln, the director of the employment department. Just four legislators, two from the House and two from the Senate, are on our board. So it's a fairly large and diverse group of individuals. Federal law actually sets the membership requirements for all state workforce investment boards. Yet the requirements we've laid on ourselves here in Oregon have mandated that we have a larger membership than this federal law requires us to have. The bill that we're talking about today would retool that perspective and say that our state board should follow the federal requirements, and that would allow us to be more flexible, give the governor more flexibility, allow us to move more quickly. You know, we have to be strategic in terms of who is appointed to that board, and we're doing that. I assure you we're doing that. But it would allow this board a lot more flexibility and room to move quickly. I also think that the board would then become more effective because we could narrow down a bit and keep our focus on our strategic objectives.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
What is the number in the federal requirement for membership? Or is it a number or just a representation?
It's a representation with a majority of business. I mean, it does call out, you know, like two labor representatives. It's got some specificity to it, but there are some generalities in the federal law, too.
Okay, well, that's 41 is an unmanageable number for a board, clearly, so.
As Cam mentioned, I just returned from Washington, D.C., and yes, the Workforce Investment Act is up for reauthorization. The House bill moved through completely through the floor last Wednesday, so we actually have a House bill that is done. It's very similar to the bill that went through the House during the last Congress, so not a lot of changes there. There is a Senate bill that has been introduced, and it's wending its way through. It is anticipated that that bill will make its way through fairly shortly, actually. I'm really pleased to say Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming and Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts seem to be really much more committed this term to getting through that bill and getting reauthorization completed during this Congress. I think that for the Oregon statute to have flexibility, aligning it with what the federal mandates will allow us to do that. And then we won't be back at you saying we've got to change the composition of our state board to be in alignment with the federal requirements. We will have a board that can move as the federal law moves and changes. I think that, you know, the duties of the board remain the same. You know, even changing the composition slightly, our focus, our charter, our mission to advise the governor and his workforce development specialists on workforce development here in Oregon, that won't change, that won't falter. We are committed to the future of all Oregonians. And that we have current membership. We're pretty fully populated. We may have one or two vacancies at this point, but we have staggered terms. So as we narrow down the composition of the board in terms of who's there and how many are there, we would like to see people drop off as their terms expire. That way we keep kind of a rolling cycle of people coming on and going off and don't have them all coming on at the same time or all going off at the same time. It's my understanding in talking with CAM's office there's no fiscal impact as a result of this bill, so it's pretty clean and straightforward. I think there are a couple of amendments that CAM wants to address with you today on the bill that I've been apprised of and understand and support as well, as she will go through the description of those. And so with that, I'd like to again say thank you for providing me the opportunity to present before you today, and I look forward to your support of this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Harvey, I'm going to ask you a question before we turn it back to Ms. Price-Broly. I have a bill that's up in Rules Committee tomorrow morning about executive appointments, and it's an effort by the legislature to take back part of that process to sort of make us a co-equal branch of government, which I don't think we are anymore. And one of the things that I want to do is streamline the executive appointments process and take away some of these from the purview of the Senate that are really, they're important, mm-hmm. but they're not important to Senate confirmation. And so we were trying to narrow them down to ones that, you know, people who have fiduciary duty, people who have are dealing with money, you know, these real major boards. If you know, and I know you're aware of this, all the members of the workforce board are subject to Senate confirmation.
Yes, they are.
And I have lopped them off and asked in this bill that we not do that because I think the governor can make that judgment. So I'd like to ask you, in anticipation of my testimony tomorrow morning, how do you feel about that?
The OWIB is an advisory board to the governor. I mean, ultimately, you know, the governor has the final say in terms of what he would like to do and get accomplished here. He does listen carefully to our recommendations, and we've seen action on his part to carry forward on those. But again, we don't have any direct fiduciary responsibility of our board. We do look at budgets like community colleges and that from time to time. We do look at how funds are expended in terms of the employer workforce training fund here in Oregon. But I think in terms of what if we align the composition of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board with what's federally mandated, you know there's some structure around who will be on the board anyway, because mm-hmm. we'll have to be in compliance with what the feds require us to do. So mm-hmm. I think for the OWIB, you've got your check and balance with the feds.
And that was the answer I was looking for, because I agree with you, and I think it's just an unnecessary extra step, and I'm willing to cede some of these to the governor, but I want the Senate to take some real serious steps to bring that executive appointment process back here into the Senate, and the bill does other things like creating investigative staff and things like that, which I think is really important for us to do our own independent analysis of the governor's appointments. But I appreciate your answer. That's very helpful.
You're welcome.
And so, Cam, do you want to quickly tell us? We don't have an amendment here. This is an amendment you're drafting. Is that it? Okay. And I've read them here, but you can briefly go over them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on Senate Bill 187, we are asking for two changes that came to our attention after the bill had, after we'd passed our ability to make further changes to the bill as it was originally drafted. First, the federal law does mandate that there are four legislative members on the board. Legislative Council did voice concern that some of the duties that are in the work of the Workforce Board might present a separation of powers problem for those legislators. They might be both legislative and taking both legislative and executive action. They asked us to check with our attorney, and in checking with the Assistant Attorney General, they concurred with that opinion, and so the amendment would be to make the legislators, not remove them from the board, but make them ex officio. And the second change is that we actually have hard-coded into this bill that there be a five-year plan we have for the Workforce Investment Board. The state does a five-year unified plan. We would like to take those words out, because right now reauthorization is talking about a two-year plan, but it may be four. So we would like to not have to make a five-year plan if that's not what's required. So those are the two amendments that I would like to have you entertained.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any questions by the committee? Any concerns about that? And my goal here is to have these amendments drafted for you, work with Ms. Taylor as to whether you're satisfied with the way they've come back, and then we'll just bring this bill back and whip it right out.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming today.
For your time.
All right, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 187, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 394. And I think we have the Honorable Senator from Tumalo here, if I'm not mistaken, home of the little drive-in with the special little nuggets. I can't remember the name of that drive-in, Senator, but maybe you can share that with us.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 394 establishes a tax credit, a personal income tax credit, for an amount paid by a taxpayer as community college tuition or tuition at a public or private institution for higher education for the coursework taken by that particular taxpayer. The tax credit is either the lesser amount of the tuition paid or $2,000. And this applies to tax years beginning in January 2006, and this bill has a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay, great. Now, who might this gentleman be in front of us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and regrettably, you are mistaken. It is Tumalo, Madam.
Oh, not Tumalo. Tumalo. Excuse me. I was close.
And also, regrettably, that quaint little drive-in has changed hands about 27 times since we had the tater tot, I believe, the divine, you know.
It is. We shared tater tots together. I'm never forgotten that, Senator.
So that's my testimony, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, this is really more information than I needed.
Well, you know, what I want to tell you is that I was passing through the beautiful, you know, community
Tumalo.
Of Tumalo, and I called Senator Westland on the phone, who was a representative at the time, as was I, and said, hey, are you up for getting together for a Coke or something? So there you go.
Is this back in the days of the snake?
Actually, it was after the snake,
oh,
yes.
After the snake, okay.
Yes, I was still trying to negotiate getting parenting rights back. So now the snake is back home, and no one knows what that is except all of us that came over from the House. But anyway, Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's get back to the matter at hand.
I am here in heartfelt support of Senate Bill 394, and I have a fun, necessary, and entertaining story to tell you that is really, most significantly, an example of how our process and our system is supposed to work. This is one of those things that we rarely get involved in, but is an affirmation of what we're all here for. One day I received a call from Linda Schweringen, who is with us here today, a former county commissioner and an individual very committed to her community, as is evidenced by the fact she is volunteering her time to teach a civics class at our local community college. And she asked me to come and speak to the students about how our process works, hear their issues and concerns. I was thrilled to do it. Certainly, showed up with interest and enthusiasm, had a very frank, candid dialogue with some of the students who pointed out, among other issues, that one of their greatest and crying unmet needs was the ability to afford a tuition, even at the community college level, an education, because of tuition restrictions at the community college level. We thought about that, we ended the class, and we all walked together up to the Great Hall where, as was anticipated, Governor Kulongowski was due to speak. They were getting, so to speak, a total immersion in state politics, and as we waited in the ante room for the governor to arrive, who was, as we all understand, understandably late, the students, not I, the students came up with a tax credit proposal that I thought was very unique and ingenious in that it specified, and this is a differentiation from prior tax credit bills that have been presented to this body and we've all heard, but their specific approach was that the tax credit be granted only to the taxpayer taking the tuition or taking the credit hours. Under the $2,000, and we might need to look at some income restrictions. I mean, I've verified that the witnesses here today are not any Allens, Gates, or Walton, so I don't think we have an issue there, but there probably should be an income screening applied. That notwithstanding, this very excellent bill proposes a modest $2,000 tuition tax credit for the income of students taking those tuition hours. The fun thing in the story is that we kibitzed on that and talked back and forth and discussed the concept, and I got on the phone to LC and we got the bill started to be drafted right there that very day. Then we all walked in to hear the governor come in and propose his broad sweeping higher ed education reforms along with the $600 million scholarship access fund. And as he's outlining the proposal for this very ambitious, very noble, but as of yet regrettably unattainable goal, I'm watching the governor propose a very necessary but very ambitious proposal. And as I'm watching him do this, I thought the wiser suggestion was presented by the students back in the anteroom. This is a bill we have to address and vet. So, with your indulgence, Madam Chair, I would like to ask you to ask not only Linda Swearingen, but we have some of the students here today. Let's put a face behind this public policy. I appreciate very much.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Westland, while you had this group of students before you, and I'm sure they were totally raptured, in rapture of every word you said, did you happen to inform them of who the greatest rock and roll band of all time was?
I qualified my support of this bill by their knowledge that the Who is without questions, without debate, last word, no other subject shall be discussed. The Who is the greatest rock and roll band of all time.
Well, with that comment, you have my support.
I think I missed something there, didn't we?
You missed a lot in the 60s and 70s, but, you know.
I was busy. Thank you, Senator Westland. We have three chairs, so Ms. Swearingen, have you bring up two students at a time, and then we'll dismiss two, and then you can bring up the other two. So whoever wants to be first. And, we're going to get three students. Okay, that's fine. Great. And I've got several on the list, so I don't know who you all are, and I guess we'll start from your left.
Yes.
And state your name and where you go to school and all of those good things.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Smith, and I'm 21 years old and a former student at Central Oregon Community College. I graduated in December of 2004 with an Associate's of Arts degree. I intend to
what
return to
school?
Central Oregon.
Central Oregon. And your mascot?
Bobcat.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Sorry, I didn't go to sporting events. I intend to return to college this fall at Pacific University. About a year ago, I was talking to an out-of-state friend about taxes and tuition. She mentioned that she received a tax credit for her college tuition in her state, which made me wonder why I didn't receive the same in my state. Mm-hmm. I began to talk with friends about why college students in Oregon did not receive a similar tax credit. Governor Kulongowski came to COCC last winter to talk about his commitment to higher education. Some of my fellow classmates in Linda Swearingen's political science class went to hear the governor's speech. While waiting, we pitched the idea to Senator Ben Westland about having a tuition and fees tax credit in Oregon for working students. He liked the idea, got a cell phone, and called legal counsel and started the process of having a bill drafted for us. Last June, a number of us from COCC came to Salem and pitched the idea to Daniel Santos in the governor's office. Now we are here today telling you about what led to the Senate Bill 394. The past 2.5 years, I have been working 30 to 40 hours a week, along with earning my associate's degree and maintaining straight A's. This has been difficult to do, but a necessity to be able to support myself and pay for school. My parents have tried to help with the cost of tuition, but have not been able to contribute much because of their financial situation, and this fall I have two more siblings entering college. This means that there will not even be a little bit of help that I have been receiving in the past. There are scholarships, grants, and loans to help with the cost of college, but they only go so far. And so to go back to school, I'm working full-time and in the process of getting a second job to make sure that I can afford to go back. This hopefully should give me enough money for school, and if I continue to work full-time while earning my bachelor's degree, I'll be able to support myself. Senate Bill 394 is designed for students like me who support themselves while going to school. This tax credit is a way for Oregon to provide financial relief for working students and invest in Oregon's future. Not only do we have job skills, but we are working to improve them and eventually get better paying jobs. This means not only are we paying taxes now, but in the future we will be giving back more to the state. With the rising cost of higher education, I know it has become harder to afford college expenses along with rent, food, electricity, and all the other expenses of supporting oneself. It would be a relief if the state could provide some sort of aid for working students, and a tax credit is a way of doing that. I strongly encourage you to support the bill because it would be a way to invest in the future of Oregon and provide tax relief for working college students, because the students who work and go to school are not only contributing now, but contribute much, much more in the future.
Thank you. Ms. Smith, can you tell me what state your friend came from who had a tax credit?
Colorado.
Colorado.
They no longer have the tax credit. They have a voucher program now.
They have a what program?
Voucher program. They changed it last year.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, thank you very much. And next.
Do I need to speak
yes.
to somebody?
Yes, you do. There's people watching. All over the
oh, no.
All over the world.
Pressure's on. Well, thank you for the opportunity to appear before this committee. My name is Rachel Nolan. I'm a full-time student at Central Oregon Community College. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 394, which would provide tax relief to college students in the state of Oregon. I can only imagine the demands placed on you to create a budget that meets the needs of the citizens of this great state as you struggle to balance the limited resources of a weak economy. I ask myself how I could come before you today and ask for a tax cut in a time when the state needs all the tax dollars it can get. The reality is that while this will reduce the tax that college students pay in the short term, the state will actually reap greater benefits over the long term. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the mean year-round earnings of a high school graduate is approximately $34,000, while a graduate of a four-year institution earns approximately $60,000. That's a $26,000 increase in yearly income. Over a 30-year work period, that would yield an increase of $780,000. Just think of what that means in terms of income taxes. It is widely acknowledged that college costs are becoming increasingly less affordable to students. Tuition rates have risen rapidly in the past decade. I have first-hand knowledge of this because I first enrolled in a community college 10 years ago. For the 1995-96 school year, I was charged $32 per credit hour at Mount Hood Community College. That works out to about $500 per term. I was able to attend school and work without receiving any financial aid. This year, that same institution charges $63 per credit hour. I spend over $1,000 per term on just tuition and fees. I work part-time, approximately 25 hours a week, and I also hold a federal work-study position as well. Yet I'm unable to pay for the cost of attendance without financial aid. In addition to the increased cost of attendance, students in Oregon face another setback. According to the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, the average state grant aid per enrolled undergraduate student is $354. Washington State provides an average of $483, while California offers $367. Oregon, on the other hand, gives only $133 per student. President Kennedy once said, "Our progress as a nation can be no swifter than our progress in education. The human mind is our fundamental resource." I ask for your support today in making the cost of attendance just a little more affordable by reducing the tax burden placed on students. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Nolan, and I appreciate the facts and figures you put in your testimony. It's much the same testimony I got in the Ways and Means Committee about the amount of investment in aid that we're giving our students. It's pretty chintzy, if you ask me. And your comment about federal work study and still not being able to make ends meet. I was a work study student too for 4 years while I was getting my bachelor's degree. And the biggest chunk, you know, you get your tuition paid for and then you got to go buy the books.
Yeah.
And that just about, I mean, that blows every bit of change that you have. And so you eat macaroni and cheese or ramen. What are you eating these days, ramen?
Top ramen?
Yeah. 10 for a dollar or something like that? Yeah, we ate Spam and things like that back then. It was pretty gross. But I appreciate your testimony and your comments because they're really right on. And so far, both of you have been very good. And so I know that Ms. Chappelle is going to tell us some really good stuff as well.
A father.
You know, he's a father. He's preserving these moments.
Absolutely.
Okay, so why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, my name is Tammy Chappell, and I wanted to say thank you, Senator Walker, and the committee members for letting us be here today. I am a 36-year-old married woman, married for 16 years, mother of 5 children, working as a detox technician, counselor aide, and a full-time college student at Central Oregon Community College. 4.5 years ago, I was arrested for falsifying documents. During this period of my life, I was a methamphetamine addict, dealer, and methamphetamine cook. After being arrested, I entered a treatment program and spent the following year getting my life back together. I regained custody of my children near the end of that year. My husband also entered a treatment program, and after completion of his treatment program, he returned home. At the prompting of a close friend and mentor, Linda Swearingen, founder of Bridge to Hope Ministries, I entered college 2 years ago. I will be graduating from COCC this June with a certificate in drug and alcohol counseling. I plan on completing my bachelor's and master's degree in social work. Currently, my husband is just getting started in a small business that is barely supporting us. My parents help when they can by paying for gasoline for me to get to and from school. They are also mentoring us in the management of having a large family and teaching us how to live on a small income. I am in support of Senate Bill 394 because it would help relieve a lot of financial pressure for our family and families like ours. I see a lot of single moms, people in recovery from addiction, and young families get started attending college only to drop out when the cost becomes too much. This bill, if passed, will make the difference in our family's life, the family and many other young people's lives who are trying to become productive members of the society and in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chappell. And you are to be commended for what you've done with your life. That's really admirable.
Thank you.
Any questions by the committee? I don't think we have any, but thank you, all three of you. Appreciate it. And I'm going to call up the last two people on our list, Ryan Swearingen and Linda. I have a feeling that Ryan is related to Linda in some way. And then I need to get Senator Devlin on before 4:30, so hopefully we can finish up.
Good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Swearingen, and I'm a full-time graduate student at Portland State University. I will complete my master's degree in special education this summer. I also work full-time at Columbia High School in Portland. Senate Bill 394 is a $2,000 tax credit for higher education that would benefit both working undergraduate and graduate students alike. This bill is designed to assist individuals who must work to support themselves while attending school. I can attest from personal experience that it is extremely difficult to attend graduate school and to work full-time. However, financial aid is not sufficient enough to cover tuition, books, and living expenses. This bill would encourage working students like me to continue to further my education while I'm still in the workforce paying taxes. In order to take advantage of this proposed law, a student must pay taxes to receive this benefit. It is not set up to assist parents who pay for their child's education, but is solely designed to reward working students who pay state income taxes. Parents should be encouraged to help pay for their child's higher education. Nevertheless, there are many instances where that does not happen for a number of different reasons. This bill also encourages individuals in the workplace to further their education. We all know that higher education isn't cheap. In fact, it is very expensive and out of reach for many members of our society. This bill would make higher education more affordable for those who need it the most. I would encourage you to do everything in your power to create an environment where workers do not have the opportunity for their education, but they can also do so at a reasonable expense. Senate Bill 394 is a big step in this direction. Thank you for your support of workers and students who are enrolled in higher education.
Thank you, Mr. Swearingen. I appreciate your testimony, and you're right. I don't know how you can work and be a master's student in a very demanding program. So you'll be to be commended for that. I find generally men don't multitask very well, but often I'm proved wrong. Thank you. Ms. Swearingen, is this your fine son?
This is my fine son, and he does a wonderful job working as well as attending school, and his father and I paid for his, well, the majority of his undergraduate coursework, and decided that if he wanted a master's, he needed to pay for it, and so he's decided to do that. And we're extremely proud of him. And for the record, my name is Linda Swearingen. I'm a former adjunct professor at COCC, as well as a former mayor and county commissioner, and currently I'm a lobbyist here on other issues outside of higher education. And last year, when the governor and Senator Westland came and spoke, it just got the juices going with the kids in the classroom, and they said, what could we do to make a difference? And so it was fun to see them get involved and to actually come up with this on their own. And I kind of thought after spring term had come and gone, a few months passed, that they'd all forget about this. Well, they have not forgotten about it. In fact, we have about 10 to 15 other students that will be here to testify on the bill as it moves through the process, if we're so lucky. And so it's neat to be involved with students that really want to come in and make a difference. And so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer any.
Oh, well, I agree with you. I really, I just am overjoyed when young people take an interest and when you realize something is broken and how you can fix it, and just really appreciate it. And I'll let you know, and your testimony, Mr. Swearingen, you said that this is designed to reward working students and not assist parents. And I'll let you know, as a parent, I was able to take a tax credit for my children, for me paying their tuition. There's a federal tax credit available, but there's not one available to you, and there wasn't to my children. We weren't paying all of their education either. We were just paying, helping them with the books, and they had to get loans, and they pay on those today every month. But I think your idea has merit that all of you came up with, and I'm prepared to move this bill to revenue. I hope my committee members feel the same way, and we'll see how it fits in with the whole package that we have to deal with here. You know that we have a tough time here in the state with our revenue right now, but I don't think your idea is enough to shoot it down right now, and I'd like to see it move forward and see what we can do with it.
Correct.
So, thank you. All right, well, we appreciate your testimony. We have no further people signed up to testify. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 394. I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 394. And Senator Starr, would you have a motion for me?
Yes, I would. I move, Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 394 to revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 394 to revenue, the Senate Committee on Revenue, with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say Senator Westland said something about maybe looking at an income test, and I'm not sure from my perspective that's necessary. I would think any college student that is working should have this available to them. If they're showing that sort of initiative, they shouldn't be punished for what their parents or somebody else does. So I think it should stand the way it is.
Well, we've got a due pass recommendation on it the way it is. So,
but just for the record, I mean, Senator Westler made that point, and I'm not sure income test in some programs make sense. I'm not sure in this one it does.
Great. Well, unfortunately, Senator Deckard is not here today. He had another obligation. He's the chair of the Revenue Committee, but Senator Starr serves on that committee.
I'm vice chair of that committee, Madam Chair, and I believe that there's another restriction in this, if I read it right, that the credit could not exceed the tax liability of the student mm-hmm. who is receiving the credit. I think that's appropriate, and so I'm very much in support of this, and we'll be looking at it favorably when we get it over in Senate revenue.
I think that's a well-stated point, Senator Starr, and I appreciate that. All right, if there's no further discussion, any objection to moving this bill? Not hearing none, we're going to move this bill. It's going to revenue, and I want to thank you again, all of you, for coming to testify. And thank you, Senator Westland. You're welcome.
Senator Westland, do you want to testify on these other bills?
The one problem I really have with this bill is when I went to the class, they were playing The Who, and it wasn't loud enough, so I didn't turn it down.
Kids.
I'm sorry we know that information from you.
Okay. Great, thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 5 and call up Senator Devlin while Marjorie Taylor is telling us about it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 commends the Linfield College football team for their exemplary intercollegiate athletic achievements, and these would be the Wildcats.
Oh, Wildcats, yeah. All right. Identify yourself for us, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Richard Devlin. I represent Senate District 19, which is Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, small communities of Durham, River Grove, and portions of southwest Portland. This morning, or this afternoon, you may know that I've not been here for about a day and a half, and I'm here in spirit, but probably not in body today. The thing I'd like to talk about in relationship to this is at the beginning, I've only done one resolution like this before. That was a House resolution, and that was a memorial to a person in my community who had served the community well, who died as a very young man when he was 42. So it's interesting that the second choice in 9 years is this resolution honoring the Linfield College Wildcats. And I want to tell you basically that I'm doing this for a number of different reasons. One, I think we need to recognize people in the state that have done remarkable achievements, and I believe the Wildcats have done that. Two, I think it's important to recognize that the Wildcats in Division III receive no scholarships. They basically play for the good of the game, and their accomplishments have been remarkable. That's why I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Senate Concurrent Resolution 5. SCR 5 recognizes the intercollegiate athletic achievements of the NCAA Division III national football champions, the Linfield College Wildcats. To give you some idea of their record, they became the NCAA Division III national champions by defeating the University of Mary Hardin Baylor Crusaders of Belton, Texas on December 18, 2004 in Salem, Virginia, the score of 28-21. They, unlike many divisions where people are selected in advance who will play in national championships, they have to go through a round of championship playoffs, and so they had to go through 5 rounds. They did have a bye in the first round, given their remarkable record, but they played 4 teams competitively, and they finished the season. They had 9 games in the regular season, which they won all of them, and they finished the season with a 13-0 record. In the 2004 season, they scored more than 650 points. This is with a season of average of more than 50 points per game. Linfield has won 5 consecutive Northwest Conference title championships and have advanced to the NCAA Division III playoffs 4 times out of the last 5 years. Now here's a statistic that is hard to actually believe. This 2004 is their 49th consecutive winning season.
Oh my.
The longest streak in college football history. In fact, I haven't checked it out, but some people have told me that it's the longest winning streak in all of NCAA history in any division in any sport. Also, I'd like to point out that their quarterback, Brett Elliott, who comes from Lake Oswego, set the NCAA passing season records for yards and touchdowns. He threw for 4,695 yards this season and threw for 61 touchdowns. Also, their head coach, Jay Losey, was named Division III Coach of the Year. I urge your support of SCR 5, which acknowledges the impressive accomplishments of the Linfield football team and the athletic department. And I might point out for the record, so some people consider this a conflict of interest, my son is a senior at Linfield, and he also is an assistant coach on the team.
All right, Senator Devlin, any comments or questions?
Sure.
Senator Cruz?
Just for the record, for for a good portion of those 49 seasons, they were actually NAIA, not NCAA. I know that, and I know the program very well because I went to Willamette and we played them, and mostly not successfully, as it turns out. They have had very few coaches in their history. They've just had really good ones that stay there a really long time. It's an outstanding program. And by the way, that averages out to 4.7 touchdowns per game, which is pretty amazing. So touchdown passes per game, which is pretty amazing. So just no history. It's, you know, I was thinking I'm not going to support anything having to do with Linfield, but I guess I will this case.
All right. Senator Starr has a comment here.
Well, I have a couple, yes, and I'm very supportive of this. Linfield College football field was next to the house I first rented when I came to Oregon. I was able to crawl up on the garage and watch the games. It was 1960, which was 4 years into their winning record, and it was also the fourth year of my marriage. My wife and I have been married 49 years, and I hope they keep winning as long as we
stay married.
Stay married.
So cool. What a sweet story. Wow. Well, with that, I think we need a motion. Senate, yeah, I know. We need to do the work session, too. Senator Devlin, thank you for sharing this exciting information about Linfield College. And I'm sure your son didn't choose that college for its winning season, but for its good academic program.
That's correct.
That's exactly right. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on SCR. I'm going to open a work session, and the man who's been married as long as they've had a winning season has a motion for me.
Madam Chair, move SCR 5 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr moves SCR 5 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? We're moving that bill. SCR 5 is going to the floor. Senator Devlin, we'll close the work session, and you can carry that bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And then you are here on Senate Bill 575, so we're going to open a public hearing on that so that you can give your testimony and go off to your meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And wait a sec. We've got to hear from Ms. Taylor.
Yeah, right. Okay, so, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 575 gives students at community colleges or state institutions of higher education and OHSU, who are also members of the National Guard and who are also ordered for active duty, gives them certain rights related to the courses that they're enrolled in at the time that they're called up into service. And I'm sure that Senator Devlin would like to explain more about the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I would like to state for the record, since it was brought up earlier, Superintendent Castile knows that I will be delayed in this committee hearing, so we have a later scheduled meeting. Senate Bill 575, I'm here today to support. I believe the service of military personnel called to active duty for their state and country should be recognized and that certain protections should be available to them upon their return. One component of such protection is their ability to easily transition back into their studies at a post-secondary institution. Their call to active duty should not be an academic or financial setback to their studies. This bill is modeled after legislation that was introduced in Minnesota that passed their legislature in their 2001-2002 session. Minnesota's version passed without a single vote in opposition in both the House and the Senate and was signed by their governor in March 2002. It applies at community colleges, state institutions of higher education, or the Oregon Health Sciences University, to members of the Oregon National Guard and who are ordered to active duty. It gives the student the right to withdraw from classes without penalty, complete all classes left incomplete when called to active duty, receive credit for room, board, tuition, and fees, be readmitted or re-enrolled within 1 year after release from active duty without redetermination of eligibility, receive continuation of scholarships and grants awarded by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission,
under these conditions, the institution may not give the student a failing grade or incomplete if the student withdraws for National Guard active duty. Can they alter the student's grade point average due to the student's withdrawal from the course? It's a relatively complex bill. There are a couple of technical amendments that both the university system and community colleges would like to see to the bill. They both agreed that those amendments could be made in the House. Some people have brought forward the fact that in some cases institutions have adopted similar policies, particularly recently. And what I pointed out to people is that this should be the policy of the state, not simply spurred by the interest of the moment in the sense, or our clear recognition of how many troops, particularly National Guard troops, that we have in Iraq and other areas. I joined and toured some of the troops that we had in 1997 in Croatia, and I'm pretty sure that the institutions did not have those policies in place in 1997, and that's why I think it would be a good idea to put these on record in state statute. Those two corrections that they are seeking, one having to do with private financial aid in terms of giving them some latitude, because in the case of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, some parties that are giving out aid may not be willing to actually put the aid off to a further year, so it would give them some more latitude. And there is a drafting error in the bill in terms of community colleges, where some of the rulemaking authority that it actually talks about does not rest with the Department of Education, it rests with each community college board. And so those are the two technical amendments that we're going to seek either here or in the House. I think it's a very good bill. I think the one thing that we have to keep in mind in all of this is that sometimes the impacts on members of the armed services that are called up to active duty don't simply happen when they're called up or when they're on active duty. They happen 5 or 10 years later when things within their records come back to haunt them. And this actually gives them clear indication of what the standards are should they have to withdraw, in many cases on only a few weeks or days notice. And I think it would be a very good addition to our state statutes, and I've been told by the university system and community colleges they do not have an objection to it. They're just seeking a couple of technical amendments. And if I might cover one other issue, just because I think it will come up in this committee in other bills. We have quite a few bills that are drafted having to do with National Guard, veterans, etc. Some of them use relating clauses relating to National Guard, which is something that this does. It has been brought to our attention that some of these benefits should be extended to reservists, and I'm in agreement with that. However, those amendments could not fit within the relating clause of this bill. One of the things I have done in preparing for this hearing is I have talked to the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, and I will be talking to the chair of that, both the House Rules Committee and the House Senate and the House State and Federal Affairs Committee, the chair there, of in the end of this session, if we could pass a single bill that would not include all of these bills, but would simply just clarify that these benefits would be extended to both National Guard members and reservists, regardless of their service. Because we're going to face this issue with a number of bills, because Legislative Council drafted a number of them just with the relating clause of related to the National Guard.
Good fix.
Yes, Senator Cruz, you're right. And Senator Devlin, I had received a letter on February 18th that I forwarded on to Senator Devlin about that. That came from a man in Portland, or actually, yeah, Milwaukee, who made that suggested change. And so I'm glad to see that this is, that you're going to be able to fix it in this manner. I think you'll find support for that in the House as well.
I would clearly state that to all the committee members here, including the chair, I clearly believe these issues are not partisan issues. No. Mm-hmm. And I think we can come to easy agreement on some of these. And it was just an oversight on my part. It was not intentional. We actually just drafted this almost exactly like the Minnesota legislation, taking into consideration differences in Oregon statutes. Mm-hmm. But
since their legislation just dealt with the National Guard, that's how ours ended up relating to the National Guard.
Thank you. Senator, I would ask you, I really am loath to send legislation to the House that needs fixed here before we vote on it. If you want to, Madam Chair, I've been actually conferring
with parties. I can get amendments prepared for this within a week.
Okay.
And if I could have the chair's indulgence to bring it back in a week or two, I would be happy to do that.
Yeah, we have several cleanup days, and I don't get the sense that any of the members here are opposed to this bill. And we've got some testimony that will probably be pretty quick from the community colleges and the university system basically saying that they agree, I'm sure. And so I'm happy to get this on the agenda just, you know, really quick. But I just don't like voting on legislation that we know needs fixed.
I can understand that, Madam Chair, particularly given that this is early March.
Right. If we were talking about late May, I'd be thinking a different story. And also given that I know there's support in the House for these things. So if you don't mind getting those amendments drafted, you can work with Ms. Taylor about that. Okay.
I will do that and get back to you as soon as we have the amendments ready.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Then I'll call up,
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Senator. Carl Jorgensen with the Oregon Military Department, Lisa Zavala, and Andrea Henderson. Why don't you all three come up at the same time? Sir, why don't you start first?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I am Carl Jorgensen, the Director of Financial Administration for the Oregon Military Department. Brigadier General Byrne, the Acting Adjutant General, and Colonel Mike Caldwell, our Deputy Director, are in Washington, D.C. this week. I've been asked to represent the Oregon Military Department on their behalf concerning Senate Bill 575. The Oregon Military Department supports this legislation. Since 2001, over 5,300 Oregon National Guard soldiers and airmen have been ordered to active duty by national authority. This is 67% of our force. Over the same period, the governor has placed 1,600 National Guard soldiers on state active duty for wildfire suppression, mainly in the summer of 2002. Of the 5,300 members ordered to federal active duty, 96 of them were also attending colleges and universities at the time of these activations. 330 Guard members currently attend college while maintaining their active membership in the Oregon National Guard. The Guard works hard at retaining our trained and experienced soldiers and recruiting new members to the force. So as one of our top priorities in recruiting, this legislation supports these efforts and certainly demonstrates a genuine appreciation for the sacrifices our soldiers and our airmen make. So I wish to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of our dedicated soldiers and airmen. And we support this bill. This concludes my testimony. May I answer any questions?
I think we're doing fine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. Ballard?
One will do. Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Yeah, stereo.
Yeah, I was a little intimidated. For the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Here today to fully support the intent of Senate Bill 575. As Senator Devlin indicated, I have talked to him about some needed amendments, and I'll address those in just a few moments. I did want to indicate, however, that the Oregon University System presently has in our administrative rules and in our academic fee book the ability for National Guardsmen and reservists to receive a full refund of either their tuition or to receive credit for coursework that they have already achieved if sufficient coursework has been done, and also a refund in prorated room and board fees if they are called up and cannot complete the term in which they're enrolled. In addition to that, the State Board of Higher Education has just endorsed a new fee remission program for members of the Oregon National Guard and reservists who are deployed in combat zones. That is one of the most recent examples of our support for Oregonians who are serving and have served our country. As I said, students are called into active duty while enrolled, have the option of either a refund of tuition and fees or credits, and also they receive the prorated refunds for campus housing and food credits. We are requesting one amendment to the bill so that we can continue to comply with federal regulations regarding financial aid awards and to also the honor of the, to honor the intent of those who have created privately funded scholarships with their own goals and eligibility criteria. The bill requires the continuation of scholarships and grants, and our proposed amendment would exempt those financial aid, federal financial aid awards and private scholarships as those are governed by their own eligibility criteria. So I will work with Senator Devlin. I might just mention that that would apply also to the CUNY colleges, their financial aid awards, as well as OHSU. So I would be happy to work with Senator Devlin and his staff to develop the language.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. I can answer any questions.
I don't think so, Ms. Henderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Andrea Henderson of the Oregon Community College Association. We also support Senate Bill 575 and believe that it's important that we provide these services and benefits to our veterans. We have one technical amendment to the bill on page 2, line 15. Currently, the legislation grants the authority to promulgate rules to implement this legislation to the State Board of Education. Actually, tuition decisions are made by local community college boards. We would want to change that to have the local community college boards actually implement the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, well, I think that does it. Between your testimony and Senator Devlin, I think we've covered the amendments, so we'll look forward to getting those. I don't see any comments or questions by the committee, so thank you very much, and I'll ask you to stand back, and you'll be back up here in a moment to testify on another bill that we've got.
Thank you.
All right, so Senator Devlin, we'll get those amendments going and put this back on the agenda as soon as we can. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 575. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 543 and call up Sean Cruz from Senator Gordley's office while Ms. Taylor reads us information about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 543 directs community colleges and state institutions of higher education to treat veterans and current National Guard members who have returned from deployment in combat zones as residents for the purpose of admission and determining tuition and fees. This has an emergency clause, and I'd like to point out that the National Guard members are not only from Oregon, but from all over the country, those people who have served in combat.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Cruz, identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Cruz. I serve as Senator Abel Gordley's legislative aide, and I'm here to represent her office. Senator Gordley wants to express her gratitude that you're hearing the bill today. This seems to be a day for good bills in this committee, and here's another one. Senate Bill 543 directs Oregon's community colleges and state institutions of higher education to treat veterans and current National Guard members who have returned from deployment in a combat zone but technically aren't veterans yet as Oregon residents for purposes of admission and determining tuition and fees. In the simplest of terms, this bill is a welcome call to veterans and qualifying Guard members across the nation that Oregon honors and respects the sacrifices they have made or are making or will make to the benefit of Oregon citizens and to the state of Oregon. This bill offers to veterans and qualifying Guard members an opportunity to gain an education in Oregon at the same time, at the same tuition rate as Oregon residents and paying the same fees. It does not mandate admission to any institution. I realize that Oregon statutes already provide for avenues to gain resident status while a citizen of another state. These avenues offer a technical way around the problem, such as filing an Oregon tax return a year before separating from active service. Fundamentally, the laws require that the applicant establish a significant Oregon connection in order to gain residency status. I want to suggest that rather than encourage veterans and qualifying National Guard members from other states to pursue an arcane technical strategy for admission and residence rates, it is better for this committee and this legislative assembly and the governor of the great state of Oregon to openly clear a path to a better life and extend a public welcome across the nation. I want to suggest that a member of the armed forces or a National Guard member from California or Utah or New York City or anywhere else serving in combat in a foreign war does so in service to Oregon, defending Oregon and Oregonians at the risk of life and limb and great sacrifice is in fact a significant Oregon connection. Proof of serving or having served ought to be sufficient to qualify an applicant for admission as an Oregon resident. Lastly, I want to point out that our institutions of higher learning have indicated there is ample enrollment capacity and that National Guard and regular armed forces enlistments across the nation are down. It is an additional benefit to Oregon that active National Guard members from other states come here to learn, to acquire job skills, to live, to raise their families, and perhaps to transfer to the Oregon Guard. We need the Guard, and we need the Guard right here at home. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Any questions of the committee? I'm getting a question asked and answered. Okay. Okay, great. Well, I'm going to have you stand back, Mr. Cruz, and I'm going to call up the other folks who've come to testify, and they actually support the bill, so that's a good thing, and as well as this bill. So Carl Jorgensen again and Andrea Henderson, and Lisa, you're not testifying on this one? You have no issue? Okay. Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I'm Carl Jorgensen, the Director of Financial Administration for the Oregon Military Department. On behalf of General Byrne, I come before you to represent the Oregon Military Department on Senate Bill 543. The Oregon Military Department sees the intent of this legislation as honorable and clearly supports it and asks if we may offer a minor change. In current statutes, National Guard soldiers and airmen are considered residents of the state for the purpose of admission, for determining fees for tuition, and payments while attending any educational institution in the state under the State Board of Higher Education. In previous sessions, we asked for this language and the consideration, sought the relief, and received it. Members of the armed forces who leave active duty to attend college and move to Oregon may consider joining our Guard to take advantage of our educational benefits we offer and that the Guard members currently enjoy in the state. Senate Bill 543, we asked for a friendly amendment to delete lines 18 and 19 on page 1 and delete lines 5 and 6 on page 2. These lines read as more restrictive than the current statutes, for the legislation adds National Guard service in a combat zone as a requirement, whereas now all Guard members, regardless of their service or where they have served, qualify as resident status.
Oh, that's an important point. So could you repeat that?
Certainly.
I mean, I know what you want to delete, but the last sentence where you said all National Guard members qualify as residents no matter where they're from?
In current legislation, okay. Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you. That sort of clears up a question I had up here earlier. Okay, perfect. All right, thank you. And Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, just a concern in the language. It says veterans of armed forces. So if you're active duty or reserve duty, I mean, when do you technically become a veteran? I would think, is it when you...
Upon separating from active duty, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz.
So if you're in the reserve, you're a veteran.
The veteran would be post-service, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz. So.
Okay, I guess I'm just wanting to make sure that in the language we aren't excluding anybody in any service branch. And when it just says veterans, veterans of armed forces, so if they're on active duty, they wouldn't be qualified, right?
In Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, in the current statutes, all service members of the armed forces are certainly considered as residents in the okay. state. If their posting is in the state, that would be Coast Guard servicemen serving in a ship stationed in Astoria.
My point, I just want to make sure we weren't inadvertently excluding people by language. So.
However, though, veterans are not mentioned in the current statute yeah. that is in this bill.
Right, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Taylor had brought out the statutes and was assisting me in trying to understand that. Do you have any
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the most significant changes in Senate Bill 543 is that it adds veterans to those people who would receive in-state tuition. The statutes for community colleges and for the university system define active member of Armed Forces of the United States, define the Armed Forces of the United States, and dependent children are also currently allowed to have in-state tuition. So right now, community colleges and university system, they provide to spouses and active members and dependent children. So now that's just adds veterans to it. That's my understanding of what's going on.
Okay. And does that comport with everyone's understanding here, Mr. Jorgens?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Okay. Great. Okay. Were you concluded with your testimony, sir?
My testimony is concluded.
All right, thank you. Ms. Henderson?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Henderson from the Oregon Community College Association. We also support this legislation. And I wanted to take just a moment to point out some of the other ways that our community colleges are also working to help veterans as they return to the state. Many of our community colleges are currently offering free tuition to veterans that have just come from active duty as a way to help them as well, and are also offering other services to help them with their veterans benefits and to help them have specific services for the veterans at the community colleges. So I just wanted to mention that the community colleges are very supportive of helping our veterans and support this legislation as well. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for taking that initiative with that legislation. We appreciate it. Are all the community colleges doing that or just some of them?
Madam Chair, at this point, some of our community colleges, but many of the other community college boards are considering it as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you both. Mr. Cruz, can I have you come back up for a second? I know you need to take this back to your boss, but were you aware of the amendment that the department wanted to suggested today?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And is Senator Gordley in agreement with that amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, she is.
Okay, yeah. Great. That's all I needed to know. So what I would like you to do is work with Ms. Taylor in getting that amendment drafted, and we'll bring this bill back the same time we bring the previous bill. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you all for testifying. Senator Starr, you have a question?
Not a question, a comment, Madam Chair. It's amazing. I've got some relationship to this kind of legislation. And 47 years ago, having returned from active duty, desiring to continue my studies in the graduate school at the University of California, I applied for and was granted in-state tuition. Though I had entered the service from the state of Idaho, part of that I think was rather technical to work through the problems of getting that. But I was married and had a child, and I was returning from service, so they did in fact allow me to go at an in-state tuition rate at the University of Cal. And so I'm very supportive of what we're trying to do here. And we get the amendments, see if we can move these.
I think it's great, too. I really appreciate the way the citizens of this state and all across the country have pulled together to support our veterans. It's not always been the case in our country. And, and you know, for whatever reason people had to do that, I'm not going to question that now at this point because we're just going to move forward. And I think what we're doing here is good, and I appreciate Senator Gordley bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 543. And, gee whiz. I'm impressed, and because we do have two nightly meetings that we're going to schedule, and we're working with your health policy committee or whichever one that is, so that she doesn't schedule at the same time.
That would be nice.
Because we've got some issues that we're going to need to spend some time on in the evening hearing. One of them is on Senate Bill.
Former Senate Bill 10
about tuition for
non-resident
aliens. I can't remember how we described that. Do you recall that bill?
They're not non-resident. They are
resident
alien graduates of our high school.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Senator Starr, you hit that right on the head. My vice chair stepped up to the plate to help me out, and I appreciate it. And then the second nightly hearing will be on...
It has to do with Senate Bill 6, the performance enhancement.
Oh, Senate Bill 6, which is performance enhancement drugs.
Really?
That they're using in athletic programs at some schools, and also defibrillators, making those more available. So those will be some nice nightly hearings. And
the Congress has just subpoenaed a whole bunch of baseball players on the steroid issue, and it's basically all Hall of Famers. It's going to be very
well. That'll be entertaining. That's where we're headed, colleagues. Thank you very much for your attention this week. It's already Wednesday. We'll see you on Monday. We're adjourned.